Okay, well, a very good evening to you all. My name is Tony Travers from the Institute of Public Affairs here at the LSE in the Government Department. I'm here to chair this evening to facilitate the discussion that will follow on this most topical of subjects. I'd wise open the importance of a smooth transition to a new EU deal. And I'll say just a little bit more of that myself by way of introduction in a moment. The Twitter hashtag is hashtag LSE Brexit, and you can see it there at the bottom of the screen. And what I want to do first is just say a few words about our two guests, and then very briefly by way of introduction, a few words about the subject before disappearing down into the audience. So we have two speakers this evening who can then get going with their presentation. And the two speakers are Carolyn Fairbairn, who is the Director General of the CBI, and Rayne Newton-Smith, who is the CBI's Chief Economist. And I'll just say a little word about each of them first before introducing the topic. Carolyn is Director General, as I said, of the CBI. She began her career as an economist at the World Bank, then went on to work at The Economist magazine, has worked at McKinsey, has had a range of roles in the private sector, spanning manufacturing skills and the banking sector, became BBC's Director of Strategy, where I first met Carolyn some years ago now, and subsequent to that, was Director of Group Development and Strategy at ITV. I think it's fair to say few people in public life have as wide a view of both public and private sectors. Rayne Newton-Smith is the Chief Economist at the CBI, was previously Head of Emerging Markets at Oxford Economics, and before that had a distinguished career, 9 years at the Bank of England and part of the time at the IMF. So two people who will, in a sense, be able to tell us more about what business now feels it needs from the process of the Brexit negotiations. Hard to think of any two better. Just a couple of words from me before we get going. We're now a year and 2 weeks on from the EU referendum, which occurred on the 23rd of June last year. And in the intervening period, I think it's fair to say, against some expectations, the economy has continued to grow, but now, looking ahead, appears to be growing slightly less strongly, and with the suggestion that there might be more of a downturn. And, of course, with the uncertainties surrounding Brexit, now potentially undermining consumer confidence and investment. And I think the problem that business has, and all of us have, is that the nature of the government's negotiating position is such that it's hard to be certain whether the government has a fully worked through plan that they don't want to fully reveal because it's part of a dealing process, negotiating process, or alternatively doesn't have a fully worked through plan, but we don't know that anyway. And trying to work out which of those two it is complex for anybody involved in the study of government. Recent media commentary suggests that ministers are increasingly detaching themselves, coming up with their own views about the way this process should be handled, which itself is interesting, and it's not unique to Brexit, of course. Just one final point. Over 80% of employment in the UK is within the private sector. Many of the companies who are members of the CBI, as it were, contribute a significant proportion to that 80%, which means the capacity of business to represent its particular case on Brexit and on other issues such as taxation policy and public investment, the way it does that and represents itself to government is of concern to us all. Carolyn has recently been quoted in the media as warning about a disorderly crash landing if government assumes it can safely walk away from the Brexit talks. What we're going to hear about this evening from Carolyn and Rayne is directly from CBI's representatives how the Confederation of British Industry and its representatives hope that that disorderly process does not end up in that disorderly way. Ladies and gentlemen, Carolyn, Rayne.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for that very kind introduction. And I'm absolutely delighted to be here tonight at the LSE and joined by my colleague, Rayne Newton-Smith, our chief economist. Thank you so much for inviting us, and thank you so much for your great air conditioning. Much appreciated. Now, for those of you who don't know the CBI, we speak for 190,000 firms of all sizes, from startups to entrepreneurs to large multinationals, in all parts of the country, from St Ives to Inverness, and employing over 7 million people. And this evening, we want to talk about Brexit from the grassroots perspective of these companies. Now, though it's a serious economics lecture, we are, after all, here at the LSE. Our aim is to use plain English about the impact of different Brexit outcomes on firms, people, and jobs. This is what we mean by eyes wide open. Now, as business, it is not our job to run the negotiations, but it is our job to be clear about the consequences. And although we're talking about the impact on companies, what this is really about is the future of jobs, growth, and prosperity in all parts of the UK. And frankly, it couldn't be more important. I've spent much of my last 4 weeks since the election visiting firms across the country, and to my mind, it is a time of really quite extraordinary opportunity. I do believe we have the chance to become a world leader in this next wave of technology revolution. And the reason for that is because it's all about creativity, innovation, science, ideas, the application of knowledge to manufacturing and services. And these are the UK's great strengths, in no small part due to the excellence of our great universities like yours here at the LSE. Now, we are already excelling in the growing tech-based industries of the 21st century. We're creating thousands of high-quality jobs both inside and outside London, and you see it everywhere you go. In the pioneering energy firms of the Tees Valley, the thriving digital cluster outside Cardiff in Wales, our very own Silicon Valley, in the fintech revolution taking place on the streets of Edinburgh and Glasgow, and in Belfast's burgeoning cybersecurity industry. These are just examples of what the UK's future could look like. The choices made round that EU negotiating table, if made well, could brighten this future. But if made badly, they could significantly dim it. So, tomorrow will be exactly 100 days since the UK triggered Article 50, and that means 630 days to go and counting. Now, businesses are watching. They're watching all over the world. They're making decisions right now, decisions about whether to make investments, where to site their headquarters, and ultimately whether to employ people. And, of course, people are watching, and they too are making their decisions right now about whether to stay in the UK or apply for jobs here. And of course, universities are also making those decisions, from planning international research to hiring the best lecturers and attracting outstanding international students. Now, how we leave the EU, how we leave the European Union, could affect all of this. And to be absolutely clear, tonight's lecture is not about whether we leave the EU, it's all about how. Now, firms across the United Kingdom are committed to making a success of Brexit, but right now, they are telling us that they are concerned about two things. First, Tony mentioned it, they're concerned about a no-deal outcome. The prospect that when the clock strikes midnight on March the 29th, 2019, time runs out and we leave without a deal. And second, that we may have the outline of a deal, but where's the transition to get there? What's the bridge to the new future, which keeps things simple, that minimises disruption and maximises continuity, a transition period which lets us focus on what really matters, how we get the best new final relationship with the European Union. And tonight our proposal is that we need to build this bridge as soon as possible with our European partners. So our lecture this evening is in three parts. First, I will talk about why we need the smooth transition to a new deal. Rain will then talk about the economic impact of leaving without a deal. That's the real economics. I'm a very rusty one. And then I'll finish with some thoughts on what a smooth transition could look like. And crucially, the urgency and the spirit of mutual interest with which we need to approach it with our European partners. So let's start with trade. Now, trade really matters. It creates more choice, more innovation, lower prices, and ultimately, higher standards of living. But of course, modern supply chains are inherently complex. Global companies operate across borders and are highly connected in a myriad of ways. Products are subject to regulations, standards, protections, guarantees, and trade agreements, which in turn involve a range of actors, courts, agencies, regulators, consumers and employees, often from across the globe. Complexity in trade is a fact of life. The more markets you deal with, the more rules diverge, the more complex it gets. And this can act as a brake on trade and a burden on business success. One set of rules for selling to France, a different set for Italy, and another completely different set for Ireland. And that is exactly how it used to be. But in the last 40 years, EU integration has cut through the complexity, making things simpler for business. The single market means one single set of rules for the whole EU, saving Europe's 23 million firms time and money, while the customs union lowers even further barriers to trade. Now, this can all feel pretty abstract and theoretical, so let me take three real-life products to illustrate what we're talking about, and crucially, what we need to think about when we're leaving. So I'm going to start with a simple loaf of bread. Let's take a factory located in County Antrim in Northern Ireland that delivers fresh loaves each day to both Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. It gets its wheat from a supplier in the Republic, and as an importer, the baker needs to know that the wheat meets food safety standards, on pesticides, for example. Now, these are monitored by agencies on both sides of the border, applying a common EU rulebook. As both the UK and the Republic of Ireland are in the single market and customs union, the wheat can be transported freely without any customs checks or import tariffs. This ensures the wheat arrives on time, and because it's perishable, that really matters. Now, bread, as we know, goes off, it gets stale. So all deliveries need to be on the road by 4 a.m. so the bread does arrive fresh. Again, EU standards smooth the way. Take the lorry that transports the wheat over the border and into the factory. That driver has a European driving license, which has exactly the same criteria as every other member state. This combines with the European Community HGV license, which registers the vehicle and harmonises the rules, which put a single limit on the number of hours the driver can do, allowing both driver and lorry to cross the border freely. Now, let's turn to our loaf of bread itself. The additives and preservatives which keep the bread fresh are defined by the EU, and they're used worldwide. To improve the bread shelf life, the loaf is packaged. Under EU labelling laws, this packaging must list allergens and nutritional information, amongst other things, so customers know what they are eating. A single set of information which allows the bread to be stocked in both Belfast and Dublin with exactly the same label. So there you have it. Something as everyday as a loaf of bread. EU rules essential for cutting through the complexity and making things simpler for business and cheaper and better for consumers. But of course, it's not just food. In cosmetics, some products cross the channel 5 times before they arrive in a shop. So let's take a lipstick sold in a pharmacy in Leeds. Now, a single lipstick, I didn't know this, but I've learnt it, can contain dozens of ingredients, waxes to help it keep its shape, oils and fats to give it the right texture, and of course, pigments for that all-important colour. Now, these ingredients are all regulated by a single set of European EU standards. Now, on top of this, the address of a legal representative, a responsible person, must be published on the lipstick's packaging. This person, who must be based in the EU, gives a product information file on the lipstick to the competent authority of the member state where the address is registered. The quality and efficiency and safety of the product information file means it's viewed as a gold standard across the world. But here's the best part. Only one file is needed to be able to sell this lipstick within the entire single market, again, making things simple for business. This means today UK firms can with total ease access a European cosmetics market worth almost £70 billion. A final example, a car. Now, a car has been more talked about, but actually there's a lot going on in making a car. Today, if someone puts an order in for a new car, they can change things like the car's colour or whether it has a sunroof up to a week before delivery. Then the way it works is those different parts are gathered from suppliers across Europe, shipped to the UK through the Channel Tunnel, and they arrive on the factory floor at exactly the same time. It's just-in-time assembly. And any delay at all, means taking the vehicle out of the production line, which is disruptive, costly, and means the factory makes fewer cars per day. And automotive firms importing parts from Belgium and Germany allow only 15 minutes for delays. That's what just-in-time means. Now, thanks to the single market, they can import parts from all over Europe without worrying about customs checks slowing them down. EU trade arrangements also allow parts to be imported tariff-free from a range of third countries. From wing mirrors to South Africa to auto-electric technology from South Korea, the EU's global reach helps UK firms to thrive. And the benefits go beyond the nuts and bolts of the car itself. Increasingly, we're all buying cars on finance, on personal contract plans, and these often require a small deposit followed by a fixed monthly payment. Now, these, again, are underpinned by EU regulators, with passporting allowing financial service firms in one member state to offer services in another with no additional barriers. So the single market reduces cost and complexity and increases choice for consumers across the entire automotive supply. And of course, we must not forget what this means for the employees across the UK who work in these sectors. 300 bakery workers in the factory sites in County Antrim, 445 cosmetic SMEs in the UK who can grow and thrive. And the UK single market supports the automotive industry in the UK, which employs over 800,000 people, 78,000 young apprentices. So forgive the detail, but it's important. It's really important. These are just a few examples of where the EU has cut through complexity, creating a single, simple set of rules. So, of course, the $64,000 question is this. What happens if things change? And in particular, what happens if they change overnight? What might happen then? So, next, I'm going to hand over to Rain to look at the possible consequences of how we leave the EU, and in particular, of leaving without a deal.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm Rain Newton-Smith. I'm the CBI's chief economist. And 18 years ago exactly, I sat in one of those chairs just up there listening to macroeconomic lectures when I was studying for my master's here at LSE in economics. But tonight, and in the next 15 minutes, I want to look at what would happen if we didn't get a deal with the European Union. First, we need to understand a bit more about what we're good at, what we've gained in big picture terms by being part of the EU single market, and why a smooth transition is so important to all sectors of the economy. The EU encompasses the deepest trading arrangements in the world, covering more sectors and more areas of policy than WTO agreements alone or any other trade deal around the world, as you can see by the dark red bit on the map which surrounds the UK and the EU, just showing just the depth of our trading arrangement with the EU. For goods, EU integration has been a key driver of deeper and more complex European and global supply chains, especially in sectors like automotive, aviation, and chemicals. Over the last 16 years, the share of services in the UK's total trade has risen from 31% to 44%. The UK is really very good at exporting services. Such a high share is very unusual. In most developed countries, services exports tend to account for around one-third of total exports, whereas in the UK, it's closer to a half. And if we look at this chart, if we look at services now account for 40% of the UK's EU trade, which you can see by the increase in the light blue bars at the top. That's up from 23% back in 1999, which is actually the year I graduated from LSE. Compared with an increase of just over 6 percentage points for our non-EU trade in services, which is shown by the light orange bars near the bottom. Exports of business services such as design, advertising, and architecture, together with financial services, account for over half of the UK's overall growth in exports of services. But these sectors may be particularly vulnerable to a sudden reemergence of trade barriers with the EU or that no-deal scenario that we're concerned about. This chart looks at our competitive advantage in different sectors, and what it shows is that in most of the services industries, particularly financial services and other business services, our competitive strength is derived equally from our markets in the EU as they are from markets outside of the EU, which are shown by the dark blue bars. The light blue are the EU bars. Outside the EU, the UK is highly competitive in areas like insurance and pension services, as you can see by the dark blue bars. There are clearly big opportunities for the UK in exporting services around the world, tapping into the emerging middle class in Asia and other fast-growing trade routes. But regulatory barriers to trade are often much costlier for services than they are for manufacturing. So the harmonizations of rules that we've gained through the membership of the single market is particularly powerful for services. So wherever we end up in the long run in terms of our relationship with the EU, the UK needs to avoid a sudden change in rules that would prevent us from trading to our current strengths in both goods and in services. We need a smooth transition to our new relationship to avoid disruption to our supply chains for businesses and for consumers. A no-deal scenario would be very costly for these businesses and consumers. And one of the most obvious costs would be tariffs. In a no-deal scenario, the UK would face tariffs on 90% of its EU goods exports by value. This chart shows estimates from some work that we've done on the potential costs on exports if UK-EU trade were carried out under WTO most favoured nation terms. Contrary to what it sounds like, most favoured nation terms are actually what you trade under if you don't have a preferential trading agreement in place. And what we found is, on average, the tariff across all goods sectors would be 4.3%. And if you apply this to our exports to the EU at the moment, that would be around £4.5 to £6 billion per year. That's about 0.2 to 0.3% of GDP per year. But of course, this is a partial equilibrium analysis, as we economists like to say. I'm not here taking into account how the UK economy would respond, or indeed how the economy in the rest of the EU would respond. And nor does it show that average, what it would mean for particular goods. So for the car industry, what we've done is looked at the estimate for that industry. And what you need to do is take into account the inputs that come from outside of the EU, as well as those that come from the EU as part of that supply chain. And what we find is the estimate for the car industry range from £0.8 billion a year to as much as £1.5 billion per year for that industry. So there are serious consequences for the car industry of higher tariffs. And of course, some exports would face tariffs a lot higher than this average rate. So if we took meat, for instance, it would face a tariff of 26%. Of course, what some people have said is the UK's exchange rate has depreciated a lot over the past year, and surely that will offset some of the costs of these higher tariffs. Well, that's true, but only up to a point. I spend a lot of my time travelling up and down the country talking to businesses about how competitive they're feeling and what they're seeing in their supply chains. And when we look across our surveys, what we do find is, particularly in manufacturing, their sense of competitiveness against the EU market and the non-EU market are at a 22-year high in our latest survey back in June. But importantly, the argument also applies to higher input costs. And due to the weaker pound, our imports have also become much more expensive, with input costs rising at a double-digit pace in May. And we can see that impact across our surveys and across sectors, with price expectations being at very elevated levels. And of course, for consumers, higher prices for food and other goods means consumer price inflation is likely to peak above 3% this year. And at the same time, average pay growth isn't likely to keep pace, and so we're going to see this squeeze on household incomes. So I would say certainly for households, the weaker exchange rate doesn't feel like much of an offset or offer much salvation. And input costs would actually rise even further if we failed to negotiate a deal. Because so far I've talked about a tariff on exports, but actually we'd also face more tariffs on our imports. The government has said that it's seeking to adopt as its own the EU's World Trade Organization schedules on import tariffs and quotas. And copying and pasting those arrangements for our trading relationships with every other country as far as possible makes sense. It's a sensible step to the smooth transition that we want. But if we had no deal with the European Union, the UK would be obliged under WTO arrangements to impose the same tariffs on our imports from the EU as from other WTO members. And our estimates suggest that the average MFN tariff on the UK's imports from the EU would be around 5.7%. So that applying that to our imports, that would be an annual cost of between 11 and 13 billion pounds. So that's another 0.6 to 0.7% of GDP per year. Of course, businesses would have to choose how to deal with these costs, whether to take the hit themselves, which could affect their viability and competitiveness, or whether to pass these higher costs on to consumers. But I think one of the most important things to remember is actually, I think we focus too much on tariffs themselves. Higher tariffs are actually just the tip of the iceberg. The bit that we don't talk enough about are non-tariff barriers, which are also very important. Without a deal, the UK business would face new paperwork requirements, making trade more complicated and less efficient. And actually, it's likely, if we look at estimates out there across the academic literature, that this would have a bigger impact on competitiveness than any changes in tariffs, particularly for small countries. And in fact, we looked at a study that analysed the costs faced by US firms trading with the EU that could be eliminated through a trade agreement. And we borrowed from some work by other academics here at the LSE. And we estimate that if UK firms faced even half of those costs, it would be equivalent to an additional tariff of 6.5% on UK exports to the EU. And that's nearly double the most favoured nation tariff. So I think that's just to illustrate some of how important these non-tariff barriers are. And another way of looking at that is just to look at the sheer number of non-tariff barriers that we face in terms of our trade with the EU on goods. And this chart uses data from the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. And what we see is across all sectors, there's around 405 different non-tariff barriers. The sectors that have the highest non-tariff barriers are in chemicals, agriculture, and machinery. So these non-tariff barriers, if we left the single market, would create big challenges for products like our lipstick and our loaf of bread. But I think it's important to remember that it isn't just the number of non-tariff barriers that matter, it's the type. So if we look at aerospace and defence, which looks rather lonely down there at the other end of the chart, which only has 9 non-tariff barriers, one of those requirements is the requirements for aircraft to be airworthy. And I think we'll all agree that complying with being airworthy is incredibly important and vital to ensure customer safety. So I think it's helpful to remember it's not just the number, it's what these regulations represent and what they mean for consumers, both here in the UK, but also across the rest of the EU. Another way of looking at or dividing up what all these barriers are is to think about economists divide them into at-the-border measures, and those include things like quotas, rules of origin, which help people distinguish where goods come from. And there are ways that we could use technology to try and address having more additional barriers. So we can use new IT systems to help with some of the logistical practicalities of moving things across borders and to help with the flow through some of those customs checks. And it is true that at the moment businesses that are exporting outside of the EU or importing from outside of the EU at the moment from, say, the US or China are already conforming with some of these enhanced checks. But if we left the EU without a deal, the difference would be the sheer scale of the volume of our trade with the EU. And I think there really would be big questions over whether our ports and our airports would be able to deal with the changes in the high volumes of EU trade and the added logistics that we'd need. We'd see delays to some of that just-in-time production that Carolyn was mentioned in the car industry. And actually, in many facilities, at the moment, we just don't have the space to deal with those added customs. So when the lorries roll off the ferry at Dover, for example, they run straight into the White Cliffs of Dover, and there actually isn't much room for many more logistical checks. And equally, in Calais, we'd need more space within the EU to check that any goods coming from the UK satisfied EU customs checks. So there's a lot of logistical planning that needs to be done from both sides. And this solution will require serious negotiation, and it will require the UK and EU border forces to change how they do things. So I've talked about those at-the-border non-tariff barriers. There's also the measures that we call behind the borders, and really those are the harmonisation of rules and common product standards that just make it easy for us to trade across borders. Carolyn has mentioned some of these earlier, so that standardised packaging on our loaf of bread, for example. And at the moment, the responsibility for enforcing these rules rests with a combination of national bodies and 35 pan-European regulators and international courts. And at the moment, UK firms operate under these rules, whether they are producing for the domestic market or for export. But if we left without a deal, the responsibility for making sure that UK exports comply with EU rules would shift from UK regulators to those EU customs officials. And this loss of control could mean that UK exports to the EU could be held at the border until it was clear they complied with EU rules. And going back to Carolyn's lipstick example, in the no-deal scenario, without that mutual recognition, the responsible person would need to move to another member state if they are based in the UK. So meaning the address on the packaging would need to be changed, which could mean that that small business would be forced to have two production lines, one for lipsticks that go to the EU and one for UK lipsticks, which might not be there at present. So there's lots of logistics for businesses themselves to think through. But on regulation, the repeal bill that's being tabled in the UK is part of the answer, but it's not the whole answer. While this bill will enshrine EU regulations into UK law, it just can't offer the reciprocal recognition that we need to see across the rest of the EU. Nor will it deal with the process of UK and EU regulations diverging in the future and moving potentially in different directions. And beyond tariffs, which you hear a lot about, and non-tariff barriers, which I've said we don't hear enough about, there's another economic consequence of no deal I want to mention. Without a comprehensive deal with the EU, some companies may not be able to do any business at all. And this is the very cliff edge that we want to avoid. We don't want to get up close to this cliff edge. Services industries, in particular, would not be able to rely on WTO rules alone. And let's not forget, services account for over 80% of the UK economy. An agreement governing UK and EU airspace, for example, would be needed to keep planes flying to the continent. An agreement recognising those driver's licence for those lorries would also be needed so that a driver in the UK could drive seamlessly across to the EU, as Carolyn was mentioning in her bread example. And of course, an agreement allowing financial services to continue operating under passporting arrangements would also be needed so that banks based here would be able to offer financial services across the rest of the EU. Without this, firms wouldn't be able to carry out some of the activities that are regulated under passporting. And we know that that activity is so important for our whole economy. If we look at research by Oliver Wyman, This suggests that passporting directly accounts for between 7 and 10% of value added in financial services. And spillovers to other activities could lead to a loss of a further 7% of value added. And if we look across the other range of business and professional services, some sectors could lose their legal basis to conduct business in the EU. So broadcasting, postal services, and other range of business and professional services could be affected. So if you take the legal sector, for example, JP Morgan highlights that in 5 EU member states, if you don't have EU nationality or admission to a bar in an EU member state, you're just not allowed to provide legal advice. So leaving without a deal could mean that UK law firms lose out to companies on the continent, putting a question mark over the UK's position as a European hub for global law firms. And this is what that cliff edge looks like up close. And I think we can all agree we don't really want to get close to it. And so it is also important that we look beyond the EU. And many have spoken about the benefits of new trading opportunities from being outside the customs union. So I want to talk a little bit about that. I'm well aware of this wider world as a former head of emerging markets with a keen interest in China's growth. But it's important to remember that through our EU membership, the UK has free trade deals with a broad range of countries. So if we look at this chart, the range of trade deals that we have through our partnership with the EU covers countries such as South Korea. And if we take them all together, that represents over 60% of our total trade at the moment. And if we look outside of the EU, we see that 20% of our trade goes to the US, with another 20% going to countries outside of the US. So if we are looking outside of the EU and looking to sign new trade agreements, it's clear that the US is an immediate priority in terms of scale. But let's be honest, I think any trade deal with the US certainly feels a long way away at the moment. But I think looking further ahead, it's important to understand where our biggest export markets are likely to be. And if we look to Oxford Economics, our biggest market for goods is still likely to be the EU in 2026, assuming a smooth Brexit scenario. And so even though our trade to fast-growing emerging markets over the next 10 years is set to double, so you can see that from China and India, where the overall level of trade is set to double over the next decade, and in the EU still holds the greatest potential in terms of goods, and you can see that just by the sheer scale of where we start from with the EU and where we're likely to end up. And in services, according to Oxford Economics, from 2021 to 2030, the UK services exports to India, China, and Indonesia will grow by over 10% on average per year. So that is quite a stellar performance. But even then, the services exports to these countries in 2030 would still be worth less than a third of the value of our EU exports today. So I think this is just trying to underline how important it is that we get the right deal with the EU and a smooth transition to that deal. And now I'm going to pass you back to Carolyn for the final part of tonight's lecture.
Thank you very much indeed, Rain. And I think it is pretty clear that there would be real cost to our economy of leaving the EU without a deal. And as Tony said at the beginning, I think crash landing just about sums it up. But let's stop in this final third of our lecture and stop for a moment to reflect on our goal as a country in these negotiations, on where we want to be when this is all over. We are looking for an agreement which builds on 4 decades of painstaking economic integration. We're seeking the most ambitious and comprehensive free trade deal ever agreed in history, and we're pushing for a deal which works for business, a deal which does make sure that bakers in Northern Ireland can sell their bread to Dublin without delay, where cosmetics firms can work under one set of standards across Europe, where car manufacturers can continue to bring in parts from all over the EU without red tape. Now that's the true scale of the challenge, and I do believe that we can rise to it. Business is wholeheartedly committed to making Brexit a success, And the new EU Exit Business Advisory Group, that's a bit of a mouthful, but it's a good thing, set up by ministers, is the first step towards a deeper partnership. A place where business and government can use evidence and experience to solve problems and put the economy first. The goal should be a framework for the new trading relationship before we exit in March 2019. To use the language of business, we call it a heads of agreement in writing that would allow technical talks to start and allow companies to plan with greater clarity. Yet, even with the greatest possible goodwill on both sides, given the complexity we would face, it's pretty well impossible to imagine the detail will be clear by the end of March 2019. This is a time to be realistic. So instead of a cliff edge, the UK needs a bridge to the new EU deal. And our proposal is that the UK should seek to stay in the single market and a customs union until a final deal is in force. This would create a bridge to the new trading arrangement that for businesses would feel a lot like the road they are on. Because making two transitions from where they are now to a staging post and then again to a final deal would be wasteful, difficult, and uncertain in itself. One transition is better than two, and certainty is better than uncertainty. And firms tell us this feels like common sense. But if others have alternatives that deliver equivalent economic benefits, now is the time to put them on the table. If agreed soon, firms here and from elsewhere in the European Union will know they face greater stability for a number of years and will carry on investing. They will know they don't have to adapt twice. In practice, what does it mean in practice? It would mean that the UK would adhere to the EU's common trade policy for both internal and external trade for the duration of the transition period. And staying in the single market guarantees continuity for business operations. Staying in a customs union guarantees ease of trade, not just with the EU, but with the rest of the world as well. And making the choice to stay in the single market for the transition would also mean continuing to apply the rules of the single market. So ways would have to be found to continue influencing those rules as they evolve. But crucially, it would also mean that the British Parliament and the devolved governments could have the time they need to get domestic legislation right. Implementing decisions after they've been made in negotiation instead of trying to legislate for every possibility, which is very, very hard. Now, this would free up time to focus on domestic priorities and create breathing room to get the final deal right. Making the choice to stay in the customs union for the transition would also mean continuing to apply the same tariffs on goods from the rest of the world. And what is true is that UK's room to sign new free trade agreements could be limited for a time. But the very important work of deepening trade ties with global markets could continue, as it does today, with officials and businesses already hard at work in several markets, including the US and China. And our Department for International Trade could have the time they need to prepare for the task of plotting our new global economic future. Now, the exact mechanisms to achieve this can be debated and negotiated. But for businesses trying to make decisions, this is the simplest answer to the uncertainty they face today. But let me repeat one thing. This is not about whether we are leaving the European Union. Once that Article 50 clock strikes midnight on the 29th of March 2019, the UK will leave the EU. The UK will be independent politically and no longer represented in the European Council. We will no longer have members of the European Parliament, and to the eyes of every global actor, we will be on our way. So this is not about whether we leave, but how. This common sense approach would bring continuity to firms in the UK and the EU and protect investment today. So we need to build this bridge to the new future, and with our European partners, we need to build it now. A final word, if I may, on urgency. This agreement on the transition is needed fast. Waiting until March 2019 is simply too late. And we know this because firms tell us. The prospect of these multiple cliff edges in tariffs, red tape and regulation is already casting a long shadow over business decisions. The result is a drip-drip of investment, silently taken, decisions taken, deferred or lost. A major European engineering and electronics firm has told us it has shelved plans to build a UK innovation centre. A UK infrastructure provider is already having problems retaining and recruiting skilled people from the EU needed to build the rails, roads and houses already planned. And we've heard that some firms in the chemical sector are assuming WTO tariffs in business cases for new investment and adjusting future plans accordingly. There will be a time when the threat of no deal starts to affect decisions in an even more serious way. Every sector and every company will have a different tipping point, a different timescale depending on how they do business. So for the bakery I mentioned earlier, if they decide they do need to shift production into the Republic of Ireland, they probably need about 20 months to set that up. So if 20 months before Brexit Day, they feel the risk of no deal is too high, the balance will tip and they'll have to start that move. So that could mean next month. For the automotive firm I mentioned, it's likely to be the lead-in time for their order books, which tips the scales. Now, these are filled about 18 months in advance. So if 18 months before Brexit Day, they don't know whether they'll be facing tariffs or if they'll be able to provide finance, they won't know how to price their cars. So their tipping point could be this autumn. Similarly, airlines will soon start selling tickets for flights in summer 2019, and without actions from negotiators, they'll be doing so without any clarity on whether flights between the UK and the EU will have a sound legal basis. And then again, the cosmetics firm from Leeds I mentioned earlier might just be too small to have contingency plans at all. With a tiny head office, no bandwidth to weigh up the likelihood of each scenario. So if 6 months from Brexit Day things are no clearer, they might not make that next investment or hire those new apprentices. So how this bridge to the future is built is a conversation we need urgently with our European partners. It should happen in a spirit of mutual interest and be a priority for both sides. Now, the UK should make the proposal, the simple and common sense proposal, of staying in a single market, in the single market and a customs union until a final deal is implemented. We should make it on the basis of benefit to firms and prosperity across the continent of Europe. Everyone, I believe, has this goal at heart, and we urge Brussels to agree. Breaking from its mantra that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed for the good of the European economy. Business can and will adapt to new circumstances, but it can't suddenly change overnight without any warning. Politicians might think in weeks, but business plans in years. So to conclude this evening, our lecture this evening has focused on the complexity of trade and how the EU has helped to cut through it. In recent decades, the single market and customs union have made life simpler for UK firms and, as a result, increased jobs and investment. And as we negotiate a new relationship with the EU, we should not underestimate the risks of reversing this. Leaving without a deal would pull the rug out from under many firms' feet. It would mean more complexity, a return not just to tariffs but also to non-tariff barriers. And in some service sectors, it could stop firms doing business. We need to take the right action right now. We need transitional arrangements. Instead of a cliff edge, we need a bridge to our new future. So instead of adding more complexity, let's do something really simple. In the absence of a better alternative, let's aim explicitly to stay in the single market and a customs union until a final deal is agreed. This would give government time to negotiate the deal we need, and it would give business the certainty to keep on creating the prosperity we need. This is a time for keeping our eyes wide open, keeping them focused on the benefits of what we have and the costs of losing it. And the opportunity to get things right for communities, for young people, for jobs and prosperity everywhere in the UK and for generations to come. It is a time for common sense. Thank you very much.
Well, first, thank you both, Carolyn and Rain, very much for that very clear and intellectually, I mean, slides and graphs, which we like here at the LSE, presentation. Just to start off the questioning, I suppose you'll be aware of the... I'll come nearer the microphone. You'll be aware of the arguments that will be put against the position that you've just outlined, which will particularly focus on, if we stay in the single market, we will have to accept, presumably, continued migration. And given that both the major parties, insofar as we can divine their policies on anything at the moment, seem to share a sense that migration or a particular level of immigration is too high, and that therefore somehow something needs to be done about that, and that in all the discussions that would flow from the logical position you've outlined, that one in particular would create an enormous pushback from politicians, even if on balance they believed that we do need to leave in the long term. So how do you deal with that problem?
So free movement will end as part of what we're doing here. I think firms accept that. I think the public concerns that were raised were real, and I think that decision around freedom of movement is a very real one. However, this also is about transition. So firms are hugely committed to investing in young people here today. I think you do a huge amount of it. Every business I speak to is committed to that. We do a lot already, but I think as a country we could do it better. A lot of our training is about management training. It's not enough about the skills of the future, so we are committed to that. But the fact is, it is going to take time. It's going to take time to fill those skills gaps. And so what we would propose is that this period of transition is used to get that model right, to balance the public concerns with the economic needs of our country, and to get something that is the right model for us. And so I think that those two things can be balanced, Tony. It's about getting that transition right and getting the right deal for the long term.
And on the question of transition, I mean, wouldn't, again, those who are in favour of Brexit, strongly in favour, say, if we have this kind of transition, we'll never leave. It will just go on forever. British government is better than any in the known world at just kicking the can down the road, never quite doing something. And we know how to do that, so surely wouldn't this just mean we're staying in forever and slightly different terms, marginally different terms and conditions?
Rain, you go ahead.
I think we're very... very careful not to commit to any time period on that transition, and in some ways what we'd actually want is that transition to be as short as possible, because what we want is that deal with the EU. What we want is a really good agreement with the EU that covers all areas of our trading arrangements, that covers goods, that covers services. So the sooner we can negotiate that deal, the sooner we'll be able to move out of this transition period. I think this is just something that's very practical and pragmatic, and actually offers an easier solution, I think, to get to that deal. I mean, we do know when we look across the world that trade negotiations take a long time. So I think we need to have some time to focus on making those trade negotations successful.
Can I just add one point to raise, Tony, which is I actually think that what we're proposing would make that time shorter, because instead of having to, in a sense, think about that staging post and, you know, what's that going to look like alongside the final deal. All the efforts of business and government can go on the final deal. So I think we absolutely, you know, as short as is necessary to be able to get to the best final outcome.
Okay. Right. Now, that was just a couple of opening questions. There's a gentleman at the back there and another gentleman here. Let's take those two for a start. Wait till the microphone arrives and then another one will arrive here. Okay. If you'd like to, say who you are, but don't feel you've got to. I think you may need to hold it a bit closer to your...
I don't think it seems to be on.
No. Okay. Shout loudly.
Yeah, go on.
We can hear you.
I think we can hear you.
Keep going. Shout. Why don't you... We can hear you just.
If you stand up, we'll hear you.
Stand up, the people at the back. Go for it.
Okay. In terms of the bridge that you're seeking, how far
Okay, good click. We'll just take the other one, Carolyn, and then sure. And gentleman here. Yep.
Thank you. Paul McGrail, Peace News. One question for Caroline Fairbairn. Would a transitional period have to be agreed by 28 parliaments? That includes two in Belgium, which means that the slightest problem would hold a transition period up. And for Rain Newton-Smith, two economists, perhaps more, Gerard Lyons, Patrick Minford, argue for an immediate unilateral free trade area. Is that plausible and viable?
Okay, good, short, clear questions. Carolyn.
The EEA EFTA Norway model, I think, is one that could well be on the table. We aren't specifying any particular model. We are simply talking about the continuity of being a member of the single market and a customs union. I mean, the EEA, the Norway model, does not involve a customs union. Norway is outside the customs union. It also doesn't cover services, and it doesn't cover fisheries and the common agricultural policy. So there are significant differences. We haven't passed a view on that. And I think what we are saying at the moment is let's have all of the best ideas on the table. We say that very clearly. But the objective of continuity and only one transition of businesses, for businesses ought to be the goal.
And I suppose the difference with Norway, compared with Norway, I mean, apart from many other ones, is that it depends where you're starting from, isn't it? If you're Norway with your current relationship with the EU, you are where you are, and we're in a very different starting point in terms of the customs union. I guess that's the difference, isn't it?
Well, I think that is right, and one of the reasons for talking about the specifics of individual products is I think it does just highlight how incredibly interconnected our economies are, and that you are undoing a lot of things. And what Rain talked about in terms of ports and borders, these are very real new issues for us. So I think that is a good point.
Okay. Now, 20. And which of you wants to deal with the 28? Do you want to do that, Rain?
Minford. I was concentrating on the Minford point. I mean, I think you're right. To have that agreement, we would need the agreement from the 27 other member states of the EU, but that's true with whatever agreement we get. And I think what we're trying to say is the alternative to not getting agreement from those 27 countries is walking away and falling into that no-deal scenario. And I think what is clear, both in the work that we've done and from what a lot of other professional economists have done, is that the impact of that on our economy on our businesses would be significant, and it really would have a big impact on our growth in the short term, but also in the long term. And that's what we were, I think, trying to articulate. I think on the, some of the arguments set out by Patrick Minford and Gerald Lyons, let's just take, for example, that it is possible to do this unilateral lowering of import tariffs. And, I think there are some legal issues within that about how possible that is to do even within a WTO framework. But I think even if you could, there's two big problems with it. You would suddenly move, and I think Patrick Minford in his longer paper acknowledges this, and in fact he uses the phrase, it could lead to the effective elimination of the manufacturing sector. Now, I think if you're employed in the manufacturing sector at the moment, you're not going to feel very comfortable with that. And essentially what it means is you suddenly have a sudden change in relative prices, and that's going to have an impact on some sectors more than others. And I think the argument that he articulates is you can make transfers from one sector of the economy to another, that the government could step in. But I think we all know that the problem is the real world doesn't work like that. It doesn't work as seamlessly as that. And actually, when we know from economic history, when you look at the miners in the north of England, where you saw sudden changes in world commodity prices, it can have big impacts on sectors. And in some sense, a one-off elimination of tariffs would work in the same way. So I'm not sure it's really where we want to be going from now. And I think as well, in terms of our negotiating strategy, it wouldn't necessarily be the best strategy, because when we're negotiating new trade deals, one of your negotiating tools is what your current level of tariffs are. And that's one of the things that negotiators spend a lot of time arguing, is setting those new levels of tariffs. So in some sense, what you're doing is giving away one of your best bargaining chips in signing new trade deals.
I mean, those who follow the sort of Patrick Minford pure version of this, I think, believe that there would be a massive adjustment followed by the sunlit uplands of higher levels of growth. I mean, I think, I mean that as a fairly straightforward description of how I think economists who believe that kind of have that view think it would work. I suppose the difficulty is that for that to work, if you listen to other people who are in favour of Brexit and who were in favour of it all along, when they talk about a sector such as agriculture, they begin to say, well, of course, we'd have to have rules to ensure equivalence, and they're imposing non-tariff barriers already into this free market world. And is that something that, put you on the spot too much, that your members sort of, do they sort of contain elements of both view, which is we would like some more free trade, but providing we have non-tariff barriers to protect, or indeed tariff barriers to protect us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that most of our members value the customs union. I mean, there are some that don't. For example, Tate & Lyle Sugar, they face a barrier in terms of the import of sugar, and that is, you know, we need to respect that and understand that. But I think one of the things about the Patrick Minford point of view is it does focus on tariffs, and it doesn't really have much to say on the non-tariff barriers and the harmonization of standards and rules. And I think it is just worth making just one other point about that. You know, there's a lot of concern around, for example, the arbitration of the European Court of Justice in the world of trade. But the fact is, there is no trade agreement anywhere in the world that doesn't have some kind of arbitration. And WTO has its own court. And so this is a fact of life. And I think one of the things that our members recognise and firms recognise is how valuable that standardisation of standards is and that regulation is, because it's lower cost. One production line, one set of packaging, one set of labelling. I mean, these are very, very practical points, which I think the vast majority of firms that we speak to really value.
I mean, wouldn't they just stick with EU rules, though, these companies? Wouldn't your company members just stay with it, say, well, we're just going to stick with these rules because we can continue to trade as we do now,
I think the vast majority probably would, but then you still need the recognition. Rain made this point. It's all very well for us to say we're sticking to them, but you need some kind of model for verifying that, and that's why all trade agreements have it. So I think, again, it's just eyes wide open realism about what is involved in having really successful trade, and also how difficult it is to get there. I mean, we know that the Canadian, the CETA deal that was just signed recently this year took 7 years, and that is because you are talking about regulation standards. You know, tariffs is only one part of it, and that arbitration of regulation standards is a crucial other part.
Okay, right. Let's take question there, and take two here together, and then I'll come to the back there.
Mike Gallagher. The whole sort of scenario that you put forward is very compelling, but one of the critical issues is obviously galvanizing sort of government both here and in Europe. What's it really going to take to prompt that? Could it be a crisis, a recession in the UK, or a financial-related crisis, or is there a smoother path to galvanising government?
Go for it.
Not to oversimplify it, it seems to me that there are two problems. You've got to sort out the European trade situation, and then you've got to get on with the hopefully opening up the prospects of the non-European trade. I was just wondering, is there some sort of philosophic or practical impediment, which means you can't move on to the non-European stuff until you've sorted out the European stuff?
Shall I take galvanising government and Rain takes the... I think it's a hugely important question. I think there are a couple of things. First of all, I think that we really do need to focus on the economy, and I think the voice of business in kind of talking about this very loudly and clearly, and that's one of the reasons that we have done what we have done tonight, into an environment where government has actually set up some proper channels for listening to business. So I did mention the Brexit Council. So I have to say, I think our role in galvanising government, the university role in terms of galvanising government about something which I think for many would seem like common sense. The second thing, though, is that we have been talking a lot to businesses across Europe and to the CBI equivalents in other countries. And they did put out a supportive statement today, supporting this view of the world, the simplicity that businesses need in the transition. So I think that there is a role here for business voices across Europe talking to their governments, bringing the evidence. I mean, I think this needs to go off from any kind of sense that this is not about leaving the EU. You know, we are leaving. Common sense, the practical points about two transitions is just, you know, it will just be very, very difficult to do. So I think this is the moment, actually. I think this is the moment for the ideas on the table, working across Europe and working in the UK to bring cross-party support, government support. There seems to be a listening ear at the moment.
And do you think is it easier for business, I mean, to put it brutally, to make this case now when the government held the general election, which led to the result it wasn't hoping for? That is, that the government is now more receptive to business, given that it itself is in a weaker position, to put it brutally?
I mean, I think that certainly we are sensing there was kind of a lot of questioning, I think, after the election about what happened. And I think one of the things that perhaps, you know, did happen is that the economy wasn't put centre stage enough. This is an opportunity to perhaps just reset. I mean, one of the things we said very soon after the election is that one of the things that we could do to reset is the tone of our negotiations with the European Union, which have been very entrenched, you know, red lines on all sides. And I think what we've been able to do is to say, actually, the more the red lines are entrenched, the more uncertainty there is, and the more investment decisions are being postponed. So I think there are a number of things coming together. One is that urgency coming up from firms, but another is just, yes, I mean, I think there has been just a sense of a bit of a reset. And those things coming together, I think, is a real opportunity. I mean, I think we need to be evidence-based, we need to be measured, and we need to be very clear this is about how and not whether, but we are, you know, committed to doing that. And I think at the end of the day, we can make this work. It's just going to take time.
Okay. Ray, the sequencing issue.
Yeah, so I think to be able to sign new trading agreements outside of the EU, we would need to leave the EU customs union. I think what we're suggesting is in this period of transition, when we would still be in a customs union with the EU, that we'd still be in a position like we are now, where we can start discussing with other countries about possible trading agreements. We can start that process of negotiations, but we wouldn't be in a position to formally sign. And actually, I think given our priorities and given the capacity we have in government, it's sensible to give ourselves a bit more time. But I think there is also a really important sort of scale point. And I guess as a policymaker, what policymakers are facing choices and trade-offs. And in some sense, what they need to do is look at, you know, the benefits we get from being within the customs union and the benefits of signing new trade deals right away. And I think there has been a lot of important work in this area, and there was a really good paper by NISA when they looked at by Monique Bell, where she looked at 42 countries and all the different trading agreements they had, and looked at on average what were the sort of benefits you got from new trading arrangements. And I think one of the key things that really struck me from that work is that it was clear that leaving the single market had a big cost on our trade, so it would reduce trade flows anywhere from sort of 22% to 30%. And then they looked at, well, what if we could sign some great, you know, as a new trading agreement with all the BRIC countries that was as good as the average agreements that have held with those countries so far from this group of 42 countries. And then they also looked, and that would increase our trade by 2%. And then let's say we also then looked at, let's say we could conclude the average FTA with Anglo-American countries, so looking at USA, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand,
And that would increase our trade by 3%. So you take that together, that's an increase in trade of 5%. So that's just giving you a sense of the scale versus, you know, coming out of the single market right away has a really negative impact on our... So I think these are just... It's some of that relativity of where we're starting from. And, you know, I say this as someone who worked on emerging markets for a long... You know, I am a huge believer in how much China is going to... and the rest of Asia will transform and is already transforming the global economy. But we've got to recognize that we're starting at a point where our trade with China at the moment is only 5%, whereas the EU is 45%.
Can I just pick up on another point? I mean, just picking up on Ray's point, I think this really is a time for evidence-based trade-offs. You know, there are trade-offs, and if we dig into the evidence, I think that is where we will get answers. So that kind of relativity is just an incredibly important thing to understand. And I think the same is actually true around the issues of free movement. We will get to no free movement in the future, but in terms of the trade-off that we've been making in the transition, we need to understand the cost of that to our economy, particularly as training will take time. I'd just like to make one other point. The other thing I've been incredibly struck by in conversations with members is they are excited about exporting, but actually there's an awful lot they want to try and do within the current arrangements that we have. I mean, it's very striking that Germany exports four times the amount to China that we do. You know, there are things that we can do. The European Union has more than 50 trade agreements around the world. Actually, an awful lot of this is about the ambition, the understanding, the goals of our companies to do things differently, working with the department. And there's an awful lot that we can do on that while we are getting ready for new deals in the future.
It's a slight question from an odd side of the argument. Presumably, the TUC would support a fair amount of this, would they? Do you talk to the TUC about this kind of position?
Absolutely. So we, on something like this, we work very closely with the TUC and watch this space.
Okay, right. So good. Oh, that's news.
Because it is about jobs and productivity and growth, sure, and investment. You know, that's why I think, you know, we go back to saying it's common sense. It's common sense for, you know, communities around the country. It's common sense for employees in firms. And that's what I think, if we can try and get that alliance. This is not, it's not ideological, it's not political. It's about, you know, jobs and futures and people's lives.
Very good. Okay, now there are some hands at the back. Yes, gentlemen, there. And then back the back, yeah. And then
thanks. My name's Ben Rutledge. And your message in terms of sort of protecting sustainable supply chains and trade seem to be keep what we've got, continuity over the sort of short and medium term. With wage levels stagnating and the cost of living rising, you know, in-work poverty being at a record high in the UK, use of zero-hour contracts going up, etc., do you think that your message will resonate with the 52%? I don't think Brexit's going to solve any of those challenges, and I'd support your vision, but how do you respond to the... I think many of those issues played into why people voted to leave in the first place, and what you're suggesting doesn't seem to tackle some of those problems.
That is such a good question.
The gentleman in blue, and then the woman, lady here with the white hat.
Rick Bennett, this is really a question on timescales. We've had one meeting now, and it's been driven by the EU in terms of what the priorities are. It's going to be sequential. It seems to have created a lot of controversy, and many people thought that the citizenship rights would be the easiest thing to solve, and that may be why we started off on a positive footing, but it doesn't look as if it is very positive because there's substantial disagreements. This seems to be constraining, if this is a sequential process, the amount of time that's going to be available for any detailed trade agreements. And it seems to me that it's going to be impossible to do this in 2 years, given the complexity of not only each industry having its own set of problems and priorities, but the overall process of withdrawal. I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Okay, is it going to take a long time? And yes, there you go.
Good afternoon. My name is Meeta Joshi. I'm from Surrey University. But I worked in IT and telecoms before, and we had seamless travel with reference to, you know, getting systems together for multi-million pound projects. And now, since, you know, it's a layperson's question, we are at the moment discussing about new EU deal, and I was wondering who, in a layperson's terms, do we need European Union more than them needing us? And giants like, you know, multinational companies, how much clout do they have in influencing the deals? At the same time, emerging markets such as India, which are coming up in the remote sensing and, you know, space communication area, we have ERSA. But how do we deal about, you know, the, you know, future deals with the emerging markets in space communication area as well, remote sensing? So at this, you know, my two questions. One is, you know, is there any influence by multinationals in influencing the new deal? And at the same time, when we have our trade-offs with the emerging markets, how are we dealing with the space communications and remote sensing, satellites, and, you know,
okay.
Data? Thanks.
All right, three questions. I'll come to the questions down here next.
Maybe I'll start with a question on living standards a bit. I mean, I think you make a really important point. I think that I think there's two things to remember. I think, so there are real challenges out there. One of the things, though, I think it's important to remember about the UK, where the UK economy at the moment is there are some positives. So I think we've got employment at its highest level, you know, at sort of historic highs. But the challenge you articulate is really important, that what we haven't seen is living standards improved. And actually, there's a really crucial regional dimension to this. So if you take outside of London and the South, these standard of living now are lower than they were before the global financial crisis. And I think last year we did a big piece of work looking at what sort of drives growth and productivity around the regions in the UK, and that is, you know, we need to have the right focus on education and skills, on infrastructure, but I think one of the really important elements is investment and productivity over the long term. And we need to find a better way of articulating to people some of the opportunities there are and how important it is for everyone's, you know, sort of job and livelihood that we keep that sort of openness and dynamism in our economy. And I think one of the elements of that work also showed that, you know, there's a real connection, and there's academics here at the LSE who've done a lot of work. I can see Swati Dingra, who's done a lot of work on this as well, looking at the connection between exporting and innovation and productivity growth in the long run. And I think we need to do a better job of explaining to people some of the opportunity there are, you know, for them on a real personal level through that higher, you know, productivity growth and by being a more open economy.
I think Carolyn, you were
enthusiastic. Can I say about, I mean, I mean, Rain has said it all brilliantly. I just wanted to add one more point. I think it is an absolutely central question. We have an awful lot we need to do in our domestic economy to raise living standards and to close inequalities, and it's a central challenge. One of the things that I think concerns us is that Brexit could suck the oxygen out of all of that. And I think you only have to look at the Queen's speech to see how many Brexit bills there were. I think one of the benefits of the proposal we're putting on the table today is it buys the breathing space to actually do a lot of the things that we need to do around the skills building, around the infrastructure. We know how important these things are to the kind of things that you're talking about. And innovation, which I think is going to be, as I said at the beginning, central to our future. But if we're just doing Brexit for the next 5 years, that won't work. So this is, again, I think we hope, helpful to being able to come back and really focus on the things that matter back home.
What about the gentleman at the back's point about the slightly slow pace?
Yes.
If I can put it that way, the sort of once a month sense of it all happening a bit like that.
Well, I have to say, I think that I completely agree with that. And I think that's one of the reasons that the alarm bells are going off in firms, because they are just, you know, they're watching to see, and because there is, you know, the standoff. I think the fact that we haven't got the EU citizens deal, I think, is something that we would like to have seen that a year ago, to be honest. But I think if what that is, I think, hopefully underlining is the importance of this transition, because we should be able to get to a framework. We, you know, with the right, one of the phrases that we use quite a lot back at the CBI is where there's a will, there's a way. And you can, you know, if we can get to that framework and we have that transition in place, then that's the route. That is the route. But I think we need to, as I say, gather momentum around this idea that this is, you know, a good thing for both sides of the negotiating table.
Right, on the emerging markets.
Yeah, so I think one of the questions you were asking, you know, what are the opportunities for trade in emerging markets for the UK? And I think there really are big opportunities. You know, we sort of touched a bit on that. And I think particularly if you look at, you know, the rising middle class across Asia and the sorts of things that we're seeing, an increase in demand in terms of sectors, and you touched on one of them, it is about IT. It's also about media and communications, healthcare, education, higher education, and these are actually some of the areas of financial services, pensions, where the UK does have a comparative advantage. So I think there are lots of opportunities for the UK over the future. I think one of the other things that's important, and I appreciate we're talking about sort of trading agreements, is actually there is a lot of business that's done, you know, outside of having formal free trade agreements, and obviously the UK, you know, is able to tap into that, some of that growth already, but I think we do need to think more about how we can do more of that in the future.
Okay, we've got time for two more questions, three. So one here, gentleman there, right. One here, and gentleman there.
Thank you, Alex Jan from, I probably shouldn't say where I am because this is a personal question. Caroline, given the question for me is this, is there, given the way things are going, is there a scenario in which the CBI would support a second referendum in which the question was, do we accept the deal that's on the table or do we remain within the European Union?
And the gentleman there.
My name is Ian Wilson. My question is, what I can see from your talk, why there will be interest on both sides on the deal on goods. I cannot understand why, and I'm thinking particularly of my Montreal colleague Emmanuel Macron, why he would be interested in a deal on services. Sure, he would love there to be no deal on services.
Okay.
Should I take the second referendum? No. No. I mean, we have asked our members, and they don't support a second referendum. I think what they are really focused on is getting this transition right and getting the end deal right. So that's we asked it explicitly, and the answer for the moment on that is no.
Mr. Macron on services.
So, I think there's a few things we have to acknowledge, and it's that it's harder to negotiate trading agreements in services. That's one of the reasons why there are so few of them out there. Even if you look at CETA, which is the sort of, you know, one of the gold standards in terms of free trade agreements, it covers some services, but its coverage isn't very comprehensive. And I think that's one of the reasons why it is so hard to replicate some of the advantages we have by being in the single market. But I think we sometimes underplay the benefits. I think sometimes it's a bit too simplistic to just look at our overall trade balance in goods versus the rest of the EU and to do a similar and to do something like that for services. I think you have to think about, you know, businesses in the rest of the EU. And for a French bank, passporting into the UK is vital because we have one of the deepest, you know, most complex financial markets here in the UK. So actually, it's really important for a lot of European financial institutions to be able to passport into the UK. And I think ultimately, you know, this will be a negotiating process. There'll be lots of things on either side that will influence the ultimate goals. But I think we have to recognise from businesses on the continent, there's advantages for them to being part of trade with the UK.
Okay, just one final question from me, if I may, which is, you'll be aware that, I mean, you've put a reasoned case with your members supporting it, research backing it up, for a particular need for care in the management of the UK economy in the medium term. Now, you'll be as aware, or more aware than anybody, that there are those clever people, strong supporters of Brexit, who say, it'll be fine. They actually say, it'll be fine. It'll all be fine. We don't need to worry about this. We don't need a customs union, single market. It'll be fine. We just need to go ahead and everything will be fine. Now, what do you say to people who come up with that sort of counter-argument to your, the one you put tonight?
Come to our lecture. visit businesses. Go and talk to businesses. I mean, I think that what we can all agree on is that we could make it. You know, we can do our best to make it fine. So, you know, we produced a report before Christmas called Making a Success of Brexit, and that really is where firms are. We took 18 sectors and we picked out the issues they have. But, you say, but we always say, you've got to solve these. You've got to solve the bread problem, the lipstick problem, and the Dover problem. And, you know, people kind of burying their head in the sand and pretending those problems aren't there, that way lies disaster. So I have to say, I think that this is about timeframes. It's about recognising the complexity. It's about putting this transition in place so there is the breathing space to do it. But I think my answer to them, Tony, would be go out and talk to businesses. You know, look at the evidence, look at the work Rain put on the table, look at these examples, and try and answer that question, which I think we've said, which is how do you keep investment going? How do you keep jobs being created right now, actually? So I think that would be our answer.
Okay.
Right. I think Carolyn articulated it perfectly. I mean, and I guess ultimately is if you're going into a period of uncertainty, I'd rather have, you know, a plan and a strategy and then adopt it to things as they happen. I think just hoping everything will be fine doesn't feel like you're really tapping into, you know, some of the rich work that's been done by people and that businesses can tell you as well.
Okay, well, look, just by way of finishing off the evening, I'll say a couple more words. One is, I'll thank our speakers in a moment. I'd just like to say that this is part of the school's wider programme of events about Brexit, some internally for students and some externally like this evening for everybody, and everybody's welcome to all of them, in fact, next year, arranged in part and mostly by the European Institute, who are coordinating all of this. My colleague Kevin Featherstone and Antigone's here arranging it this evening, so thank you both. Suffice to say that the presentation we've heard this evening from British business, but a sort of research version of business's view, seems to me fits remarkably interestingly into a British political scene, which itself is one of the most, currently, more unstable than most have seen it for a very long time. So the debates we're now hearing about how Brexit plays out, how the negotiations go and so on, are against the backdrop of the remarkably complex outcome of the general election. We've had three nationwide votes in 3 years, which is very unusual, 1974, the 1920s, the 1830s before that, since that happened. So we are living in unusual times, and the thing about unusual times is they do provide opportunities as well as threats. So let's end on that optimistic note. Rain, Carolyn, thank you both for coming this evening. It's been great. It's been really interesting. And thank all of you for coming and for your questions. See you again soon.